Jackson, W266DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. President Biden focuses on the Supreme
Court. Today I'm calling for three bold reforms to restore trust and accountability to the court and our democracy.
They include a constitutional amendment limiting presidential immunity, a tougher code of conduct, and term limits for justices. Former President Donald Trump agrees to speak with the FBI about the attempted assassination against him earlier this month. CBS's Scott McFarlane.
They say it's a standard victim's interview done with victims of all crimes investigated by the FBI. But clearly, this is not your average victim, and this is not your average case. There is a piece of history here.
The FDA approves a new blood test for adults 45 and older who have an average risk of colon cancer. Dr. William Schaffner with Vanderbilt University Medical Center.
Any step that we can do to make an early diagnosis to bring more people to screening for colon cancer is a step in the right direction.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Wisconsin Democrats are urging primary voters to vote no on two proposed constitutional amendments on August 13th. State Democratic Party Chair Ben Wickler says the questions are intentionally confusing and would slow down money from Washington to Wisconsin communities in an emergency. A strict abortion law is now in effect in neighboring Iowa, where most abortions are now banned after about 6 weeks of pregnancy. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers.
I feel sorry for the women in Iowa. This is a national issue. It's not just a Wisconsin issue or an Iowa issue. Women should have the right to determine their reproductive health.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court will hear two abortion cases in the months to come. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on The Shaw. 101.1 FM and 540 AM WAUK. And on the Civic Media app.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of a working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Less than 100 days till election 2024, and it's party time. I don't know if you've noticed. I don't know if you can feel the energy. Lots of it, or at least lots of it on the Democratic side. Republicans, not. But you know who's really thrilled by the fact that there is now energy in this race, that it's now a race, that there's something going on? The right-wing corporate-controlled media. Yeah, they're thrilled because evidently, they're back with a vengeance. Engagement on news sites through the roof. Because understand, Christmas, around Christmas time, retailers, that's when they make their money. Politics is how media makes their money, especially when you got a good political horse race. And it is back and back with a vengeance, because in just a week, there is energy that the Democrats haven't had in a very, very long time. Kamala Harris raised, $200 million? Since President Biden said that he was stepping aside, there are something like 170,000 new volunteers as of this weekend. And they're over the weekend held like 2,300 grassroots events. I mean, there's energy. There's people getting together. It's almost like Democrats are ready to win. And look, you know, the fear of Biden stepping aside, everyone thought there would be this big fight. There would be fracturing, you'd have, all the people eating each other. It would be circular firing squad, which Democrats are, quite frankly, famous for. And shockingly, didn't happen. Kamala Harris was able to herd all of the crazy and energize. And look, the enthusiasm that you're seeing right now is, just like I said, completely off the charts. The fact that you got 170,000 new volunteers. Those are people knocking on doors, and they're going to be calling you during dinner time to say, hey, back our candidate. And understand, the polling has all gotten a little bit closer. It's actually kind of a race. And everybody's looking, with great anticipation on, who will Kamala Harris choose as her number two. Now, I'm in the camp of, since Republicans seem to want to attack her as the DEI choice, you got to think that whoever she takes is going to be a DEI guy, because it's going to have to be an old white guy. So we'll see. We'll see what that running mate looks like. We'll see what they bring to the table. Now, there are a lot of names being thrown around. Senator Mark Kelly from Arizona, the front runner. The governor of my state here, Josh Shapiro, his name's been thrown out there. The guy I like, Tim Walz from Minnesota. I also like Pete Buttigieg. Evidently, he's not high on the list for some reason. Not sure why, but there are a bunch of names being thrown out there. But, I think a big part of the energy, and understand, this is going back to how bad the Trump campaign has been. They had their big party, they had their big coronation, they had their political theater event, and it was bad. I don't know anyone who thought, oh, that was great. I wish I'd watch it again. And the big keynote coming out of it, the nomination acceptance speech, boring. It's almost like the Trump campaign has, stumbled a bit while you've got Harris and the Democrats gaining momentum. And again, we'll see if they can continue. I think this momentum will continue, for the foreseeable future, end of August sometime, when, I think it's going to continue to rise through the convention. I'm really looking forward to the convention, because this is going to be where I think Kamala Harris has to lay out who she is. She's going to have to make the case that, I'm my own candidate. I'm going to pick up the mantle from Joe Biden and move on the path that we forged together. Because understand, one of the things, and I've had to defend this, one of the things that I made my choice of saying that, Joe Biden had to step aside, is he's got great material. There was incredible stuff that you could talk about. And it's going to get better. Understand, as we move towards the election, better stuff's going to keep popping up. The Fed is talking about lowering interest rates, which could cause the economy to, go up. And people will go, oh, it's not so bad. So all of those right-wing talking points are going to kind of calm down, but you got to deliver the punchline. You've got great material. You got to have the timing. You got to deliver the line. And sadly, as much as I love Joe Biden, he was incapable of doing that. Now, Kamala Harris, on the other hand, we'll see. Which is why the Trump camp seems to be reeling a little bit, especially after they kind of screwed up with J.D. Vance. Because I don't know if you've been paying attention, but it's been bad over there for them. And understand, that's something that you don't rebound from. Trump seemed almost invincible at one point, and now it's actually a race. And again, as I said, who's thrilled about it actually being a race? Well, that would be these big media companies, because with Harris taking in $200 million in a week, that's going to go into media buys. A lot of that's going to go into the Comcasts of the world's pockets. And like I said, it's Christmas for our media companies, because the horse race is back, baby. Now, I'm hoping for debates. Lots of debates. Trump had offered lots of debates when it was the other old guy. I would like to see lots of debates with Kamala Harris. I would like them to continue their attack on her as being weird or not very bright and a DEI hire. I would like them to continue that. Please do more of that. And as I said last week, so when it comes to pass and she hands him his hat, so to speak, there'll be no excuses. But ultimately, for me, it's about the vision of where we want this country to go. And I'm hoping that Harris doesn't get into the name calling and the argumentative stuff, but says, look, you know, this is the direction we were on. We were investing in infrastructure. We're rebuilding our manufacturing base. We're making America great, just not with a red hat. We're reinvesting in communities that used to be, and we're going to make them someplace to be. We're going to make this the future of this country bright. That's the message. And she's got great material. And this is where, you know, getting out and telling that story over and over again so people know. And oh, by the way, pointing out Project 2025 and how bad it is. Pointing out that they want to remake this country in an image that I don't think working people would be very happy with. So I'm thrilled that the energy's back. I'm thrilled that things are moving in a positive direction. I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled that there's a chance that we can save democracy. There's a chance that we can build this country back better. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Sarah Burris from Raw Story is going to be here to share some thoughts on some story about a couch. Maybe you've heard of it. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, as I said, what a difference a week makes. Wow. I mean, Democrats all energized and lining the campaign coffers and Trump just losing his mind. And look, you know, it's trickling down. A guy in my neighborhood has for the last 3 years, you know, all during the first 3 years of the Biden administration, a blank Biden flag flying from the pole. Just a couple months ago, put up a Trump 2024 flag. Flag's gone. Don't know where flag went. And the Biden flag didn't go back up. I'm waiting to see if something else pops up. I kind of want to go knock on the door, but, you know, kind of worry about getting shot for ringing the doorbell. You never know. But things are getting interesting, heating up. And here to share some thoughts on just how interesting they've gotten, I've asked our good friend, the childless cat lady. That's not right. Sarah Burris is a reporter over at Raw Story, rawstory.com, the website. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Childless cat lady here, reporting for duty.
Isn't that the dumbest thing someone's ever said?
It's the most awesome thing ever. Like, there is nothing I love more in the world than being childless and a cat lady. And it's not even my cat. Like, that's the thing, is that it's my roommate's cat. But I am so totally happy not being married to my boyfriend and having him live in a separate location than I am. And everything is fantastic.
There you go. Living the dream, so to speak. But what a week it has been. I mean, the memes,
The commentary around Trump's VP pick, you know, JD, or I got to tell you, one of my favorite nicknames that came out, Vladimir Futon. I could not stop laughing when I saw that. But, you know, between the stuff he's actually written and the stuff he's actually said and what's being made up, we're kind of, man, watching a dangerous nonstop SNL skit.
Well, that's the thing, right, is this Vladimir Futon comes from this idea that, you know, not only did he have sexual relations with the sofa, but he also really opposes Ukraine funding. And so it just, that is beautiful. Everything else, like the other dad jokes that I have spent the week embracing with every fiber of my being, I did not have sexual relations with that couch. Don't even get me started on the love seat euphemisms. There were lots of sectional sofa.
I said last week, you know, he needs a little sectional healing.
Yeah, sectional healing. There it's really hard to say that too and not say what you want to, but like, I mean, this dude, these are conspiracy theories that are so silly, and for him, you know, it's the thrill of the chase.
Couches can't run that fast. In fact, his favorite football player, Tim Couch, he didn't run that fast with the Browns either.
Exactly. So these are all conspiracy theories and they're so silly. But if you remember Sarah Palin's comment, I can see Russia from my house, that she never said that.
No.
It was something that Tina Fey said on SNL, and it became something so serious that she did say it in the political lexicon. People think that she actually did say it. And so I wonder if that's how this couch thing is going to turn out, because I mean, it is surpassed the internet, because I'm getting people who are not on Twitter, who are, you know, random family members, who are going like, have you heard about this couch thing?
Well, look, you know, teenage boys, you know, Appalachia,
right?
I shouldn't say it. You know, it's like the old joke. I was so poor, it was a good thing I was born a boy. At least I had something to play with. So, you know, that kind of thing. But here's the thing. You know, the Sarah Palin thing was based on some bit of reality, because she was asked about foreign policy, and she said, you know, Russia's in our backyard, meaning that they're not too far away from Alaska. And, you know,
she said you can see parts of Russia from Alaska, which is absolutely true. I mean, it's out there, you know,
but just not from her. Because look, I drove by her house when I was in Wasilla. I drove by her house. I was looking for Russia. It was not there.
Not there. Never going to be there. But you know, Russia would be really accommodating for JD Vance if he ever needs to flee the country. Yeah. So.
Now the one that I liked, again, I can see Appalachia from my porch, which is a Sarah Palin kind of ripoff, is actually again couched in a little bit of reality, because his book supposedly took place in Appalachia, but Middletown, Ohio is nowhere near where we define Appalachia.
And the idea that you know, he was this poor white guy with a drug addicted mother. His mother was a nurse. And so she became addicted to prescription drugs. They were making a very good amount of money his mother was a single mother, like more than a lot of
more
families
than my mother
make
made.
with two parent. And then when he went to live with his grandparents were making exceptional amount of money too. So he really didn't grow up as this, you know, poor kid. I get, you know, being what it's like being addicted to having a family member who's addicted to drugs. I think it's really, really important. The problem is that relating to that has not led him to do anything even remotely helpful on the issue. So it's like, well, then why even talk about it?
And
the military service thing, like that one blows my mind. It's like, you know, everybody's talking about he's a Marine. No, he was a reporter on the ground, and he was doing interviews for PR purposes for the Marines. That was his Marine status in combat. He never actually fought anything.
Yeah, I'm not gonna say anything about anyone's service. Like he was in the service. Fine, you know, I'm okay with that. That's a whole nother. I don't even care about that. It's the policy stuff that's really bothering me, and especially all the stuff we're seeing that he actually said and actually has written. I mean, you could jump into the not so far into the past Wayback Machine, where you know JD or whatever his name is, texted a friend about Trump saying he's just a bad man, morally reprehensible human being. That to me is kind of makes me wonder, did Donald Trump even vet this guy? Was there any vetting process to go, let's see how crazy this guy is?
Well, the vetting process was basically Tucker Carlson and Don Jr. wanted him, right? The lame old white guy bro crowd. Those are the guys who basically said it has to be him. And I think Trump just bought into it and was like, yeah, all right, fine. And now it seems like from just the articles and the people from Trump world who are coming out as, you know, unnamed sources are all saying he's having buyer's remorse. And I think he thought, you know, I've been shot at, I've got this thing tied up. And I don't remember, like, you remember we were talking after he got shot, and I was like, it's not going to move the polls. It's really not going to move the polls. People are in where they are. There is a very, very small percentage of people who are a movable vote, and this is not going to be something that I think moves them, because he wasn't shot, you know, in like the chest or the arm or something where.
So we're gonna go degrees of shot.
I'm like
the fact that he just shot himself in the foot with JD Vance. I think this will move the polls.
Yeah, I think the JD Vance thing, I think folks in those areas of the country see him for what he is, because they're just like, you know, my good old boys don't talk like that. You know, I know a lot of folks from Kentucky who sure as heck didn't go to Yale for law school. I mean, there's a lot of hoity-toityness to him that far exceeds the cultural aspect of what a legit hillbilly is, right? Like, hillbilly is basically, you know, a West Virginia redneck, right? Those are my people, but different geography.
No, and it's interesting, you know, you look at the fact that he basically sold his soul. And the way it looks, I don't know if you've been following this, you know, basically sold his wife's soul, too. To be VP. And I think he, quite frankly, could be the guy that you go, yeah, you tanked the ticket. You were the guy who screwed it all up.
And I mean, his wife will be fine ultimately, but the fact that they're trying to turn her into a trad wife, we talked about this before where I was like, look, she's conservative, but she's absolutely amazing and brilliant with an incredible law career from the Republican side, from the conservative side. She is a way bigger deal than he will ever be. And now she's basically to turn herself into a trad wife. I'm not surprised. I'm waiting for her to like have the helmet hair, you know, like that's the real,
get the Karen cut,
the real piece of it. Right.
Okay. All right. There you go. But what's interesting is, you know, watching in just, well, it's only been what, a week and a half since the convention.
Yeah.
And Trump seems to be reeling over the fact that, that Harris is now going to be the nominee. It looks like it's locked up. And, you know, even Republicans that I know are saying, you know, maybe we should be, you know, chucking our candidate for somebody else.
And I mean, they should have done that a heck of a long time ago. The problem is that now, you know, they're stuck with theirs. They already had their convention. They already had all of the people vote on it. So, I mean, at the very least with Kamala Harris, you have people who voted for that ticket. You voted for her on that ticket. If they tried to remove her, like you and I talked about this last time, it was like, that is not cool, because there are millions and millions of people who voted for that ticket. And I think that's the same kind of idea, where if Republicans want to throw off Donald Trump, that's not going to work. The JD Vance thing, if he wants to get rid of Vance and try somebody else, it's not going to move. Like, people are baked in. This election will be about enthusiasm and getting the base vote out. And if you can move that very, very small percentage of people in those swing states,
yep,
then good on you. But this is all going to be about getting out the vote for the
base. All about turnout. Yeah, as I say, a handful of vote, handful of states. And sadly, that's the balance of the nation, the future of this nation in the hands of a very few. And I argue, and you can disagree with me, the least informed, least active, least engaged voters are the ones that are movable. Everybody else, they've dug in, they've got their issues, they've got their thoughts, their likes, their dislikes, all of that. It's those handful that, I'll think about it 2 weeks before the election and then I'll decide.
And I think with Harris, she could choose somebody that could maybe move some folks just because they would be interesting. But with Trump, like, J.D. Vance doesn't move any votes. He doesn't convince anybody. This is basically the Republican Party just doubling down on Trump,
yeah,
and just, giving the base what they want. So it didn't, like, I did not get that pick. I don't understand what the heck they were thinking. But again, this is what happens when you have, the Don Jr. and Tucker Carlson bros making all of your candidate decisions for you.
Speaking about the VP, everyone's looking at Kamala Harris and who's she going to choose and, all this stuff. And in my mind, I had to laugh because the Republicans cannot stop talking about, she's Kamala's the DEI candidate or race or misogyny or anything. They just can't. They can't help themselves. And I had this weird thought that, whoever she chooses as her VP is going to be a DEI hire.
Exactly. Like she's going to the white male Midwestern store and trying to pick up a VP candidate, right? Like she's got to find some dude from a red state who would be great on the ticket. And that is basically the DEI hire here, which you're absolutely right. It's hysterical.
It's one of those things that I keep saying, when the whole affirmative action thing went around, and I kept telling my white friends who were afraid that they're going to be replaced, because there's evidence, maybe you've heard of it, there's a theory out there that they're going to replace all the white people. And I said, you might want these affirmative action programs for if you're actually right. Because if you think you're going to be the minority, why would you want to get rid of those programs?
Exactly. And that's the thing that I think a lot of folks in Ivy Leagues are starting to figure out, is it's like you have tons and tons of international students from China who are a hell of a lot smarter than Americans ever could dream of being, because we don't fund our education system the way that they do. And so they're going to get those positions because, if it's purely based on test scores, sorry, white dude, you're screwed.
Yeah, you didn't work hard enough. But here's the thing. There's got to be a way. I know my Republican friends, there's got to be a way to rig the election, so to speak, before the election ever happens. And I've heard some conspiracy theory. Maybe you can help me. But there's talk, and I guess Mike Johnson's part of the Speaker of the House, that they just won't put Kamala on the ballots. She's not going to get out in all 50 states.
That is the biggest crock of that I have ever heard. We had this whole battle about Ohio and the fear of Biden not being able to be on the ballot because they tried to create this law that mandates that you're chosen by your party a lot sooner than what the Democratic convention is. And that ultimately got fixed. And so it's like they have to nominate Kamala pretty quickly, but it's not a big deal. Like, nobody's printing ballots today or tomorrow or the next day. All of these states, it's basically like if you as the party nominee are, go through your convention and you're the person, that's who goes on the ballot. This isn't, this isn't like, oh, I need you to, somehow win this primary again. And like I said, they've had all of these people vote in all of these states all over the country. Ballots have been cast for her already.
Well, so the argument is the ballots were cast for Joe Biden, not her. She was part of the Biden ticket. She was part of Biden. But, I've had people make that argument. That, again, splitting hairs, but, you know, an interesting argument that, you know, you voted for Biden.
I think you voted for Biden Harris because that was the ticket. And, you know,
yeah,
I think anybody who tried to, I just remember last weekend being so furious because I kept hearing rumors about Nancy Pelosi wanting an open convention. And I was just like, how dare you supersede the votes of all of these people who have already cast their ballots? And then she came out for the endorsement, but it was just like, man, if you try to take away people's votes like that, that's just, the Democratic Party is not that kind of party. Their voters there are not going to be okay with that.
I thought it would be an interesting convention since I'm going. Outside the convention, you might get gassed. Inside, possibly
you might get gassed
as well. So we will see. But Sarah, as always, great stuff. I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Have an awesome week.
Our good friend Sarah Burris. Make sure you check out her work over at Raw Story. RawStory.com, the website. Quick break. Right back.
The Shaw, WAUK. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. A stray evening storm, otherwise partly cloudy, warm and muggy tonight with a low in the upper 60s. Partly sunny, some pop-up storms tomorrow into tomorrow night. Humid with highs in the mid-80s. Partly sunny with highs in the mid-80s Wednesday, storms around. It's 69 degrees right now.
Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk.
Brandi Weingarten, the dynamic and influential president of the American Federation of Teachers.
The Heritage Foundation want their way of life rather than the diverse, pluralistic democracy that has been America for 247 years. It's this fight between anger and aspiration.
Busted Pencils with Dr. Tim and Dr. Johnny. Weeknights at 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, as we talked about at the top of the hour, rich people got really richer. Pre-pandemic, rich. Post-pandemic, oh my God, rich. In fact, so rich, we have a major, major breaking accomplishment news bit. Our billionaire class, the people that we created, now officially worth $6 trillion. And I think there should be a celebration, a cookie at least, but some bit of happiness, some national celebration, maybe mark it as a day of remembrance, you know, big holiday. Because after all, look, a lot of starving children, a lot of veterans living on the streets, a lot of homeless families, they went without so that we could help this wealth class reach this plateau. Look, this is historic stuff. You know, as were my grandparents' generation, their pride was ensuring that, you know, you bought a little house, a little white picket fence, car in the driveway every couple of years, 2.3 kids, mom stays home, one income supports a family. That's what gave them pride. Us, we got a billionaire class, the biggest billionaire class ever. And here to share some thoughts on just maybe how we got here and maybe how we fix this, I've asked my good friend Will Rice to come talk with us. Will is a policy consultant for the good folks over at Americans for Tax Fairness, AmericansForTaxFairness.org, the website. Will, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me back.
So congratulations, Will. You, me, our audience, everyone, a little, we tightened the belt a little bit, sacrificed a little bit, bought the store brand instead of the name brand, just so we could have this wonderful honor.
Right. And I know the billionaires would certainly appreciate celebration. They like to be congratulated for what they've accomplished, even though what they've accomplished depends a lot on what you and I do on the public highways and the public ports and the courts of law and the law enforcement and everything else that's a collective effort. They benefit from that. they don't pay all that much in taxes to support it, but it helps them reach milestones like $6 trillion.
It is quite an accomplishment we have gotten, I got to tell you. And look, I am being facetious here, but in reality, the fact that they've gotten to $6 trillion and we still aren't going marching in the streets with pitchforks and tiki torches or whatever, with big signs like Sean Fain's shirt going "Eat the Rich" is mind blowing. The fact that we're still pointing our fingers at hungry children and single family homes is just amazing to me.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I'm not sure I would be out there with the pitchforks, but I certainly I spend my time trying to figure out how we can spread this wealth around a little better through fairer taxes on billionaires and other hyper wealthy people.
Yeah.
And I think the more people are aware of how incredibly unbalanced our economy has become, how much money is way up there at the top of the pyramid, the more people will get interested in this whole issue of tax fairness. It's already very popular if you do polling, but I want more people to know some of the details about how we can make our tax system fairer, thereby spread some of that wealth and return us more to a democracy and become less of a plutocracy.
There you go. Now, you guys put out a social media post that said Elon Musk in 2017 was worth $20 billion. A lot of money, still a lot of money. But after the pandemic, 2024, holy, $258 billion. There's part of me that goes, I want to get a shovel and go dig up Dwight Eisenhower, our last good socialist Republican president, and reenact his tax code because it looks like we need it.
Yeah, what we really need, though, actually, is because billionaires make their money differently than we do. We obviously know they have a lot more of it, but they also live differently. They make their money differently. And our tax code is currently structured, isn't terribly good at taxing the way billionaires make their money. And I should point out, you said 2017. What's significant about that date is that that's when the Trump GOP tax law was passed. And that was a law passed entirely by Republicans, no Democratic votes, that was heavily slanted towards the wealthy and big corporations. And since that law passed, billionaire wealth has doubled. It was a little under $3 trillion back then. Now it's $6 trillion.
So I guess the thanks is to Donald Trump then. We have this now wonderful national pride of these very wealthy billionaires. Now, granted, you know, we need money for roads and bridges and education and healthcare and to put food on the table and ensure that people can put clothes on their kids' back and, you know, save for retirement because a couple of generations are going to go into retirement with nothing saved. But hey, we've got this great accomplishment. So is that the reason, or is there more to it than just Trump, or is this all Trump's credit?
No, he can't take all the credit, although I know he will. And of course, he's benefited from this as a member of the billionaire class. But some of the parts of his law that definitely contributed to this was they lowered the top tax rate that you paid on ordinary income. And when you have as much income as they do, that's a big deal. They cut, more importantly, they cut the corporate tax rate by 2/5. And a lot of this wealth, the great bulk of it, I would imagine, is made up of corporate stock. So these are the owners of corporations. So when you cut the corporate tax rate, you're cutting the tax rate of billionaires. So they also made it, they made it cheaper to earn your corporate profits overseas rather than here, which both reduces our tax revenue and endangers American jobs. So there were a lot of things in the Trump tax law that contributed to this dubious milestone, but there were other stuff that was in effect even before that came along that also contributed.
Yeah, our tax code's been broken for a very, very long time. On the fact that, you know, Biden was talking about raising taxes on these people should be a reason that we rallied behind him. Sadly, didn't hear the message. But you were talking about the corporate tax rate, and, you know, just earlier today I was reading a story that said, you know, the 8 largest pharmaceutical companies in this country paid zero in U.S. corporate taxes last year. And I'm going, how is that possible? They're making billions of dollars. How is it possible they're paying zero? How is it our laws are that bad that they're paying literally nothing?
The problem is that corporations are allowed to figure their profits in two ways. They do it one way to come up with a figure that they flash to Wall Street to try to attract investors. And of course, they want that number to be as high as possible. then they're allowed to figure it a different way when they're calculating their taxes. And that's when they want to poor mouth what they have to the IRS. So President Biden took note of that. And one of the many accomplishments of his administration was that he passed a corporate minimum alternative tax, which says if you're one of the top 100 companies in the country and you're not paying at least 15%, you have to figure your taxes again based on that big number you tell Wall Street about and then pay that amount. So he's been trying to address this issue, but it's not just pharmaceuticals. There's all kinds of big corporations that, especially since the Trump GOP tax law, have announced big profits and little or no in taxes.
Now, as I understand, you know, what is it, next year, a lot of the Trump tax code sunsets, especially those parts that actually maybe had some bit of benefit for working people. Do you see those things being expanded? Do you see those going by the wayside? Any thoughts on what the future might hold for those?
What should happen is the parts of that law that actually were of some help to working people, like the expanded child tax credit and the expanded standard deduction, we should keep those. And in fact, President Biden and now Kamala Harris, part of his team, and now apparently going to be the next Democratic presidential candidate, have made this pledge that they're not going to allow any parts of the tax law expire that would increase taxes for anyone making less than $400,000 a year. But there's plenty of stuff we can let expire that helps people above that amount and far above that amount and save trillions of dollars in tax revenue that we can then invest in education, healthcare, housing, childcare, all the things that help working people get by and get ahead.
Yeah, I remember as they were debating this back in 2017, I questioned the sense in sunsetting things like the child tax credit and the things that working people wanted while making permanent the corporate tax breaks and the breaks for the wealthy. I kind of questioned which side Donald Trump was choosing to be on, because understand, they sold it as working people are going to get a tax cut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the main thing was the main aim of this law was to cut the corporate tax rate. But Republicans know enough about the American people and where things stand now. They knew they couldn't get away with just doing a corporate tax cut. So they put these other elements in as well. But the part that they made permanent was the corporate part. And the part that they made temporary were these things that some of them, yes, helped working families. The majority of it, though, helps higher income people. And they figured if we mash them together, we'll sneak in these rich tax cuts along with the middle class ones. But the Democrats are wise to that. And it's going to be a big battle at the end of next year, or actually all through next year, leading up to the end of the year, where Democrats are not only saying, no, don't extend these tax cuts for the rich people, but let's make this an opportunity to have some real tax reform. And there's a lot of things we could throw in there that would make the tax code fairer, would raise more money for us so we can invest in the American people, and would decrease somewhat the power of billionaires and other hyper wealthy people.
I'm glad you brought that up, because look, you know, there's a way of doing a much more progressive tax code, kind of like I jokingly said during the good socialist president Dwight David Eisenhower's era, where there were multiple brackets. The more money you made, the higher your tax rate went, all the way up to the very top of a 92% top marginal tax rate. But you look at what Trump did, and the numbers, you know, they lowered the numbers on rich people. The corporate tax he lowered from, what, 35 down to 20, 21, wants to go down to 15. And you've got this Project 2025 plan that is out there saying, no, we want to simplify the tax code by basically creating two flat tax brackets. And it appears to me, and I'm not a tax expert, I'm just a guy who looks at simple numbers and goes, what they're proposing is a massive tax increase on the vast majority of the working class. Have you read through these tax proposals in this Project 2025? And if you have, you know, what are we seeing in it?
Well, as I said, it's something I wrote for our Substack. It's probably the biggest collection of bad tax ideas ever in one place at the same time. I mean, they have both short and long-term goals, and the short-term goals include what you say, cutting the top tax rate that the richest people pay down to 30% from where it is now, rather than raising it, which is what most Americans want. They also want to reduce the corporate tax rate even further, as you said, like Trump wants to, down to 15%. And then longer term, they want to do things like eliminate or replace the income tax with a national sales tax. And that's about the most regressive kind of tax you can have, because if you're a working person, you spend much more of your money on absolute necessities like groceries and gas. And so you're paying tax on that. Whereas if you're a wealthy person, you don't have to spend so much on those necessities, and you're going to wind up with a huge tax cut if you get that. So Project 2025 is a terrible idea for working Americans. It's a terrible idea for almost everyone except for the very richest people in our country.
Because you laid it out there a little bit in that what they've put a line at $168,000, evidently. If you make over $168,000, you'd be paying 30% federal taxes. Mm-hmm. And if you make under that, you're going to pay 15. You know, if we learned anything from Mitt Romney during his presidential run, a good percentage of people don't pay federal taxes. So this would be a massive increase on the lower end of the working class, wouldn't it?
Yeah, for most people, in fact, workers who make over $100,000 a year, they pay more in payroll taxes than they do in income taxes. So when you're fiddling with the income tax, you're really not addressing the tax that affects most workers, that affects most Americans. So the main benefit of this change, and I should say that simplicity in the tax code isn't the same as fairness. In fact, those two concepts can be in conflict and actually are in conflict. You obviously don't want an overly complex tax code that people can hide in, but the simplest tax obviously would be a head tax. You say everyone pays $100. That's very simple, but it's not very fair, because then you have Bill Gates paying the same thing as a minimum wage worker. So the idea of having different brackets is a way of distinguishing the different abilities of people to pay based on how much money they make. So as soon as you start cutting out brackets, you're by definition making the tax code less fair.
And you know, and I'm glad you brought that up, because when people see, all I'm going to have to pay is 15% tax, you know, they maybe don't read the whole sentence of federal income tax, because mm-hmm. most of us pay less than 15% for mm-hmm. federal income tax. We pay our state, our local, the payroll mm-hmm. tax, as you pointed out, all of these things. That's just this one federal tax. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the big numbers, the very wealthy, you know, the people we talked about at the top, they would walk away with a king's ransom.
They would, and we would lose trillions of dollars in revenue, and that's trillions of dollars that can't be used to expand healthcare, can't be used to improve education, can't be used to make childcare affordable for people, can't be used to address the housing crisis that we're facing right now. So when you're cutting federal income taxes, you're just helping the wealthy and you're hurting everyone else, because most people don't pay that much in federal income taxes, and they do often benefit from these services that the federal government pays for and helps people stretch their dollars and live a better life and expand opportunities for them.
Yeah, all that's fine, well and good, fine, well and good. But we could get our billionaire class to $10 trillion. wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, I mean, if we just want to sit around and cheer the billionaire class, I guess that's okay. That's kind of how Rome went down, though. You know, we'd be cheering demigods, I guess, as our roads crumbled and our kids weren't being educated and our grandparents weren't getting any health care. It's really a choice. It's really a choice of what we want to do. And I think that the American people have made their choice, quite frankly.
No, we're going to make our choice in November, because this is one of those issues very clear where each side stands. There is no ambiguity. There's no gray area. It is a complete and total. It's night and day.
Yeah,
it seems that simple to me. But hey, maybe we do want our billionaire class to get to $10 trillion. And as I've been saying for a long time, I'm waiting for someone to come out with billionaire trading cards so we can mm-hmm. all have our favorites. We can trade them. We can have like a dream team of billionaires. It would be fabulous. Granted, we won't be able to eat or have a roof over our head, but we got billionaires, man. So last question I've got for you, on this front, you know, this isn't a sexy topic. A lot of people aren't, you know, running to the local bar to debate tax policy with their friends. Why is this important, do you think?
We can't pay for anything unless we raise the money. I mean, we have a huge national debt. The Republicans use that as an excuse to try to cut things, including Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So whatever you care about, if you care about schools, if you care about hospitals, if you care about national defense, if you care about law enforcement, if you care about science, if you care about anything that we collectively pay for through our federal government, we have to raise more money. And the people who have the money are those billionaires with their $6 trillion and people just below them. And the Biden-Harris administration has been the most progressive tax reforming administration in recent American history. And every indication is that Kamala Harris will continue that. There's lots of ways to raise money from people who have too much of it right now. And I think she's the one who's going to offer those solutions in this coming campaign.
Well, we'll see. But, you know, it does sound enticing, $10 trillion. Just kind of throwing it out there. Will, I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you, my friend.
Yeah, great talking to you. Thanks so much.
Will Rice, policy consultant there at Americans for Tax Fairness. I was joking about the $10 trillion thing. It's a disgrace that it's at $6 trillion. It's a national disgrace. That simple. Check out their website, AmericansForTaxFairness.org. Quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1968. That was the first day of a new U.S. labor partnership. The Alliance for Labor Action. The alliance was forged by the president of the United Auto Workers, Walter Reuther, and the president of the Teamsters Union, Frank Fitzsimmons. The UAW had left the AFL-CIO over differences on how to approach labor organizing. The newly formed alliance with the Teamsters stood as a progressive alternative to the AFL-CIO's approach at the time. The ALA called for forming community unions for the millions of poor and unorganized workers. It supported the civil rights movement, as well as the movement against the war in Vietnam. One of the ALA's slogans was, quote, to find answers to the urgent problems of our society. The ALA developed position papers on a series of issues. One of those urgent problems was health care. The ALA described, quote, the United States is the last remaining industrialized country in the world which does not have a national health insurance plan which would assure all its citizens at least minimum guarantee of access to needed medical care. In 1969, the ALA launched its first major organizing drive in Atlanta, Georgia. The drive targeted multiple industries and included a massive advertising campaign. But the Atlanta business community stood in staunch opposition to the unionization effort. Despite some successes, the Atlanta effort did not garner the hoped-for results. The ALA suffered another blow when Walter Reuther died in a plane crash in May of 1970. The alliance disbanded in 1972. Universal health care and many of the other causes championed by the ALA remain unrealized.
Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I got to tell you, $6 trillion in the hands of about 1,200 people? I mean, you could literally put those people in a good-sized room, and $6 trillion, when the vast majority of people in this country have nothing saved for retirement, have no rainy day fund, a $400 emergency sends them into chaos. It's crazy. It's just crazy the way our tax code has been structured to make sure that the wealthy and the powerful, I guess it isn't crazy. We have allowed them to control our government for way too long. Just amazing. Now, yesterday, I fell down one of the video crack rabbit holes. And I don't do this often. I don't allow myself to do it very often. But I was just sitting around and I just happened to be scrolling through and it got me thinking about the world that we've been trained to think is kind of normal. And you know, I grew up, you know, as a kid in the 70s, came of age in the 80s. And, you know, things were much different back then. And there was a video that grabbed my attention, just of this little guy who was harassing this big guy about not taking his shopping cart to some designated area, or he basically just put the cart up over the curb and got in his car and drove off. And this little guy was just berating him up and down, you know, every which way, you know, calling him everything but a decent human being. And it got me to thinking of, you know, in the age of video cameras, we see a lot of this kind of stuff. You know, I dare you to do something and I bet you won't kind of videos, which are trying to bait people into confrontations or some kind of violence so they can sue or whatever. Because back in my day, that happened in the parking lot. One of two things would have happened. The guy who was being harassed would have probably taken care of the person, or the guy whose job it was to take the carts back would have gotten in it. And the video got me thinking about my first paycheck paying job. It was in a small local department store chain in Cleveland. It was called Uncle Bill's. For my Cleveland audience, Uncle Bill's, yay. There were like four or five of them in the greater Cleveland area. They got bought out by some, you know, big company at the time, Cook United, who ended up, you know, eventually, you know, the big moneyed interest sucked everything out of it and put them out of business in 87. But my grandmother had made a career out of that little store, and a lot of families did. And it was a good paying, you know, family sustaining wage job for people who needed the income. And one of the people that I remember, because of this video of this guy, you know, just going up and down. And I guess this is a thing. This cart shaming, I guess, is a thing. I remember a guy named Freddie Weber. Freddie was he was disabled. He had a really bad case of Tourette's. And his job, what he got up every day to do, was to go get the carts. His job was to make sure the carts were clean, you know, pick up some stuff in the parking lot. And nobody took more pride in the job that they did than Freddie Weber did. And this video got me thinking about, had someone wanted to take the cart back, Freddie probably would have beat him up for taking it back. And it just shows how we've been changed in our thinking. That used to be someone's job. You know, much like, you know, I go to the checkout counter at the supermarket and someone is shaming me for not using the self-checkout. It's this same kind of thing that we're being trained every day to think, well, that's a menial job. You know, no, that's somebody's livelihood. And I guess I'm one of the only people who think like this, or I think I am. Email me if I'm not, because I want to hear that there are others out here who think that, you know what? People need jobs all along the spectrum of capabilities. And Freddie Weber, his job was, and did it for, I think, like 45 or 50 years. His job every day was to go out and get the carts. He would wash them down. He'd wipe them down, clean everything up. He'd go out and clean up the parking lot. But the pride he took in that, in knowing that, here's the thing, if he was at work, you knew there wasn't a cart in the parking lot. Because he would basically follow you out, take it back from you. There were never two carts somewhere. He'd run and get them. But it was that sense of, this is my job. This is how I put food on my table. And people respected that back then. And fought for that. Look, when Freddie Weber wasn't there, you know, chaos happened. And people want to know, where is he? And I guess the reason I'm sharing this is because, you know, I see us in a much different light than maybe we were back in the early to mid 80s. I think back then maybe people cared a little bit more about each other. I could be wrong. Maybe it's just what I'm seeing. But on this job front, because we're going to see a lot of jobs being lost and quickly. When the AI and the robotics and the automation and all that stuff come online, it's going to be rapid. It's going to be painful. And it's going to be shameful. And this is where my mind goes. I do think we've got to protect those jobs that people take pride in. And I guess that's my message on that, which is why when I go to a place where there is a checkout person, I go to their counter. It may take an extra 20 or 30 seconds, but you know what? They take pride in what they do. And that's how they feed their families. Just my thought. Want to hear yours? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Podcast. Also, freespeech.org. Check out the video. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickSmithShow.com.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.